the production of culture was once the domain of artists, but beginning in the early 1900s, the emerging fields of public relations, advertising, and marketing transformed the way powerful communicate with the rest of us. A century later, the tools are more sophisticated than ever, the onslaught more relentless. In the new book, Culture as Weapon, acclaimed curator and critic Nato Thompson reveals how institutions use art and culture to ensure profits and constrain dissent, and shows us there are alternatives. An eye-opening account on the way advertising, media, and politics work today, Culture as Weapon offers a new way of looking at our world. Nato Thompson is chief curator at Creative Time in New York, and we welcome him to the roundtable this morning. Thank you very much for being with us. I appreciate it.
I appreciate it, too. Thanks so much.
It seems like we need a new way of looking at the world.
Sure does. Looks like the way we thought the world works, it's not working that way.
All right, so what do we do?
Well, you know, to be quite honest, I'm much better at assessing the situation, I think, in the book than necessarily providing solutions, though we can get to that. Certainly, I think it's important to bear in mind, without going too long about it, that the kind of attempt to understand why people do things that are not in their interest is a very long project. Karl Marx thought about it. He was very flustered why the people never revolted against the factory owners. And in fact, in 1848, they brought in Bonaparte, basically brought in a dictator versus, you know, voting to kind of have their own liberation. Certainly there are certain moments that make us think about the contemporary moment. And I think the thing we need to appreciate is that we are actually deeply emotional, fragile creatures that are easily terrified. And rather than necessarily just immediately appealing for us to act rationally, I think first we just have to take a pause and appreciate just how vulnerable to things like fear and culture we truly are.
So is it possible to use culture as a weapon when culture seems to be in our current environment, and we don't know, the jury is still out, but it doesn't seem to be overly appreciated or understood?
Well, we, you know, most of our understanding of culture is still wrapped up in an early 20th century idea, in so much as if we talk about the arts, I mean, people will think of paintings on walls, they might think of video even, or a sculpture. But we think of that as quite separate from our Facebook feed or our Twitter feed or the kind of Instagram images we get, you know, just basically kind of day-to-day life. But in fact, if we just kind of get past that and we think of ways in which images and symbols are used to affect the way we feel, if we define art in that sense, then certainly we realize quite quickly that we are surrounded by it at all times. And I think the question is, given that that's the situation, how do we decipher between these things? And also, how do we protect ourselves or act in such a way that we're not completely being bombarded at all times?
You have a chapter in the book entitled Corporate Sociability. What is that?
Well, the book, that chapter in particular, goes into three very known corporations, Starbucks, yeah, IKEA, and Apple. And I look into the ways that they produce civic spaces as a way of extending their brand. So certainly, many are familiar with the way IKEA isn't just a place to buy goods. It's veritably its own universe over there. And you have kids drop-off where they actually will take care of your kids. You got these low-priced meatballs. And in a funny way, you even have to go through this warehouse, and then you have to assemble the goods yourself. But it's a much more civic participatory space than a straight-up consumer typical experience. And that understanding that a store becomes more of a place where people gather is an innovation that many stores have picked up on. And certainly, when you look at the innovations early on of the Apple store, the profound thing they offered that is so groundbreaking, it's amazing, is they hid the cash register, which is to say, previous to that, most stores you would go into, you understood the entire design was geared to face a cash register. When you walked in, you understood you were there to buy something. When you go into the Apple store, it's unclear what the point is. It's almost like you're in this Star Trek world of helping you out, where you come equipped with technological anxiety, but there's these nice young people in blue shirts to kind of alleviate that. And when you do buy something, they just pull out their phone and somehow a receipt comes out from under the table. But this is a very different kind of store, quote unquote, than what we're used to. And I think it's because they understand intuitively that a brand can actually be extended into our own civic lives.
So what power does a setup like that give them and ultimately us?
Well, the important thing that they know is clearly we hunger for civic places to get together. And we as people like to be together. And also we are desperate to have a place where it isn't about the cash register. And quite frankly, no offense, Apple, but just because you hide the cash register doesn't mean that environment isn't entirely about the cash register.
Sure.
And what we, you know, I think it also points to, I mean, we, you know, our cities get increasingly privatized, and I don't want to get like all nostalgic, but there is a hunger in us to be together as people. We are social beings as far back as evolution will go, and it's important to recognize that that need we have to be together in space makes us vulnerable to that, but also it's very real. And finding spaces in a spirit that isn't entirely coercive is a productive value that we should share.
It certainly is a value that we should share, although we are also told, and we certainly do not have to go very far to realize it, that we are also a very fractured people and we are very polarized. So when we come together, how do we overcome that, and can we do that through these cultural pursuits?
Well, in terms of polarization, you know, it's tricky because it's almost like almost the image machines of creating polarization kind of are almost self-enacting. Certainly right now, we have fallen in line where in the post-Trump election, we have fallen into this classic idea that there's a red America and there's a blue America. And certainly the elections would make you have that with the close call between Hillary and Trump at the final end. But if we just go back even a year from then, we realized there was a million different Republican candidates. The battle between Bernie and Hillary was very intense. And the fault lines, frankly, between who we are is quite mushy. And when we meet each other as people, we can easily line up into these very clear-cut Trump or not Trump moments right now that we're in. But certainly a little historic memory proves that there's actually a much more blurry space. And we do share a lot of values together, I think. I mean, our answers may be different, but certainly I think talking to each other and getting to know each other is helpful because for most Americans are broke. And that goes red state, blue state. That's just the kind of rule of thumb. And as much as I think I have a longing for the Obama era, it is useful to remember that wages stagnated and the gains from the recession went to the upper 1%. And so unless you're in that 1%, I think you have a lot to gain from talking to anybody else in America than 99% because we share a lot.
Subtitle of the book, The Art of Influence in Everyday Life. What and who are we trying to influence?
Well, that's a loaded question. Certainly, depending on how much power you have, you can try to influence everyone. But I don't want to make it just about corporations or like this puppet master behind the machine just doing all the string pulling, because ultimately, particularly in the age of social networking, we are so brand conscious and the lessons of advertising have been incorporated into how people even understand themselves that we all on social media to one degree or another are our own brands that we manage and push out there. And so we are, to some degree, I think, trying to influence each other with the tools of culture. Ultimately, I think it's good to be conscious of that and to also be somewhat skeptical, and some media literacy about how to read that and not be reactive to that would be very helpful.
The name of the book, Culture as Weapon, The Art of Influence in Everyday Life. It is published by Melville House. Nato Thompson, a great pleasure. Thank you very much for spending time with us.
My pleasure too, Joe.
Thank you very much. Again, the name of the book, Culture as Weapon, The Art of Influence in Everyday Life. You're listening to The Roundtable on WAMC.